Hello, this is Peter Freeth, and this is the Genius at Work podcast, and I'm going to be interviewing ordinary people, really, but ordinary people who have extraordinary talents, and I'm going to be getting inside their minds and figuring out how it works, and you'll find the process interesting, and you'll learn something that you're going to be able to use in your own life as well. So let's get on with the show.
This always gets a laugh.
That's hilarious.
Oh, yes.
Well, that's interesting. We laughed. So you did something which, when, who was it? Eric Morecambe did it. Was funny. When you do it, it isn't funny. But we laughed anyway.
Yeah. Was it?
Why did we do that?
I don't. Did we suddenly go to the memory? Did it trigger the memory of Eric Morecambe? And then we went from that to that. And it's not funny, but also I think you triggered it by going, it's not funny. And that became funny.
So one of the things that we've talked about before is the honesty that's in humour.
Yeah.
So was there something in that about, well, it just isn't funny? And then it becomes funny because we're acknowledging that in itself. But then why was it funny when Eric Morecambe did it?
Well, it's partly funny because he is winking it in, as I would call it. He knows that he's doing the funny face and the expectant laugh. So there's a lot of physicality involved in that.
So he's telling the audience to find it funny.
Yeah, and he's leading, basically, he's leading the witness, leading the audience into.
So that's interesting. So there are some comedians who, by virtue of the fact that they are a comedian and they're standing up doing a comedy routine, by definition, what they're doing must be funny. And yet there are people like, for example, Jimmy Carr or Frankie Boyle, who leave the audience sometimes in a moment of, oh, was that funny? Should I laugh? I'm not sure.
Yeah. Oh, there's different types of, but even I would say that Jimmy Carr and Frankie Boyle do it, but do it on a much subtler way. So, I mean, it may be just an eyebrow raise, like, I know what I've said is outrageous. So I'm leaving that with you is the thing. But I know, and I think you are smart enough to know that I know. So we're in a shared world. It was Alistair McGowan who was saying on the podcast, a lot of humour he thinks comes from people patting themselves on the back to go, oh, I get it. I'm in on the gag.
There seems to be something there about, we've talked also before about the social behaviours and how we interact and as a social species. So there seems to be something there about saying, we all get the jokes, so we're insiders. And yeah. We can laugh at those people that are outsiders because they don't belong.
But yes, it's being in.
A signal to.
Yeah, it's being in the club that is classed as smart because you've seen it and you feel superior to people who don't get it. So it's very much that superiority thing as well about you're smart enough to go along with this because we've taken you down a road and you see it. And the collective thing is I want to be in the club. So, and the more I can get in the club, the more secure I will feel by sort of connecting to a thing. And I'm also sending a social signal to everybody else. I laughed at the right point because I'm properly in the club. I'm properly smart. I'm properly listening. I'm properly connecting with everything. So, you know, now I may be leaning in to be the first to laugh at it because I'm now competitive and want to
you're reminding me there of the relationship between a leader their followers. These are people who are identifying as, I identify as a Jimmy Carr fan, or I identify as an Al Murray fan, or I identify as a Monty Python fan or whoever. And I want to be in that audience, and I want to be the person laughing at that to show that I'm like these people.
Yes, and Monty Python is a really good example. I mean, I think they're all good examples, but I a particular example, because the Monty Python thing was, you could see on many levels. You could see silly, or you could see super clever as well. And it was the fusion of those two things, of the silly and the super clever. And you wanted to be, you didn't just want to be the person who went Ministry of Funny Walks. Well, Ministry of Funny Walks worked on many levels. It was a funny walk, but then it was taking it to another level. Imagine a ministry whereby this is somebody's job. So it was satire on ridiculousness of civil service jobs. So I get it on the level.
And 1984 and all of that, Ministry of Education and so on.
Yes, you can. It's a shorthand to the subtext of I get all the references because I am clever.
There's been a short series, like a review series, about the Fast Show, and sort of interviewing the performers recently and getting them to reflect on what it was all about. And it strikes me that what they, with the majority of the characters in the sketch in the Fast Show, what they're doing is taking a person, a stereotype, and then they're changing one thing about that person to make, to create an incongruity. So they're taking these painters, these artists who are painting some lovely scene in some fishing village and it's all lovely and they've got ham sandwiches and so on, but one of them's a manic depressive.
Yeah.
Or they'll take this Cockney geezer, but he's an eco warrior. They'll take this historian, but he's in the wrong place, or is looking at
one of the funniest things. I always loved the guy who would come out of the barn.
Yeah, Jesse, yeah.
And go, this week I will mostly be wearing Issy Mayaki. Yeah. You know, that's where a lot of comedy comes from, is it breaks the spell, doesn't it? You think, you know, there's a bloke coming out from a barn. So we know where that sits in our psyche of, you know, it's a farmer who's going to come out and say something. You shift it on its head, and it's the ridiculousness of that he's going to be wearing this top fashion designer. And that simple, you know, juxtaposition of ideas, isn't it? And yeah. you break the... All comedy goes... You know, one of my the favourite gags to explain comedy is, why do mice have small balls? Because very few of them can dance. Now, that's, to me, the perfect explanation of the way comedy works, is I've given you a visual image, which pretty much everyone goes to. I've given you long enough to create the image, and then you've gone, where's this going? Then I've broken it and go, because very few of them dance. Oh, balls, you know, it's not the funniest gag in the world, but it does explain where it's going.
So we mustn't forget the context, you know, Monty Python, people expect it to be a comedy show. And even though they might not get everything that they're doing, and they might not get every level of what they're doing, they'll regard it as a comedy show and view it in that context. When we're listening to a stand-up comedian, we know that's what we're going to see, what we're letting ourselves in for. We know what the context is. What about ordinary, everyday people at work, in the pub, around their friends' houses? For them, where the context isn't, I'm going to be funny for the next half an hour, or you're going to watch some people be funny for the next half an hour. For them, ordinary man in the street, what is funny?
What is funny is being connected, is most people do lots of inside jokes, which are born of, you know, we know that, they don't know that. It's a huge question. What is funny?
It seems that we're conflating potentially a number of different things. There's funny in the incongruence and the discomfort and the sense of belonging that drives that we've talked about. And there's funny also in people just laughing at everyday situations. So some friends around the house and they're in the kitchen and they're doing cooking or whatever, and somebody drops something, breaks something. You could get mad about that, or you could laugh about it, or, you know, there's a whole load of different ways of reacting to that. So it seems that there are, in these ordinary everyday situations at work, people will go into work and tell a joke or say something to be funny, intentionally to be funny. But there's also a way that people use humour to deal with unexpected things that happen in life.
Yeah, it's a release valve, essentially. It's, you know, I think when you said, you know, you can get angry about it or you can go the other way. So there are social connectors who are brought into situations, much like a court jester, to break the seriousness of the situation. And they are valued for that.
That's interesting, because in the Fast Show, they've got a character called Colin Hunt, who's the office joker.
Yeah.
But he's actually, the twist is that he's actually a tremendously sad and lonely individual. So that's interesting, where you talk about the person who's kind of brought in to lighten the situation, almost as if there could be in any social group a person, or maybe more than one person, whose informal job it is to lift the spirits, to lighten the mood.
To see the funny side, literally. It's funny, my son's started his second year living in a communal house with five other people. And he came home this weekend for my birthday. Thank you for my card. It was wonderful. Thank you. And he essentially said, I'm there, my job is to lighten everything, to sort of like, and he's become the de facto jester in the house, whereby when people get to change, he will lighten the mood. And he sees it as his role and his function in that house already, and he's only been there 4 weeks. But he knows what his role is to be the person who does that. And I suspect he's always done that at school. You know, it's, you know, his reports were very much like mine, which is, you know, Paul is very bright, but he needs to take things more seriously.
Yes, he would succeed in life if he didn't waste so much time trying to make other people laugh. That's
Well, yeah. And all those people who made other people laugh at school and were given bad reports as a consequence of that, I suspect will have succeeded more than people who took it very, very seriously. Because I think it needs to be formally valued, but I think informally it is valued. I think it's, you know, people and go, oh no, he's the person, or she's the person who actually lets off the steam, who can, and, you know, when somebody screws something up, can put some humour around it and then get some people back to a level whereby they learn to laugh of it. Because if everybody is there going, this is a tragedy, this is awful, this is, you know, we're all going to lose our jobs and we're, you know, there'll never be any work again and everything. Well, you need somebody who's a release valve to that. You need somebody who can diffuse it. It's the bomb disposal expert. The comedy bomb disposal expert.
Well, you're reminding me of sequences in films where after a very downbeat period, there'll be something that breaks the tension.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering there if that very downbeat period where Sam's role within the house that he's living in. And I've read and heard this from a lot of comedians who talk about how, I mean, Groucho Marx hated the fact that he got invited to dinner parties just so that because people thought he would be entertaining.
Oh, yeah.
And the last thing he wants to do on his day off is tell jokes.
Oh, absolutely.
He would anyway, because that was who he was. So, you know,
it's his role. And you know, well, by the way, I'm thinking of specific instances. We were down in Cannes. And me and a guy, a friend of mine called Peter Shankovitz, who's a very funny guy, were invited to a dinner party in a long, long table. And we didn't know these people, but we'd been invited by one person. And we thought, why have we been invited? And then we looked at each other and went, oh, we're the entertainment. And it was literally, and you could see people waiting for us, go on, say something funny, lighten the mood, do the thing you do, you know, poke the bear, dance, monkey boy, you know. And we kind of went, oh, really? We're going to have to do it? But it was the social contract that we were being bought dinner at a fancy restaurant for that. It was singing for our supper, essentially. And even though we didn't want to do it, we did it. Because actually, we were kind of bored as well. And so we kind of did it out of duty, but also to amuse ourselves. That makes sense. And it goes, well, we know how to do this, so we might as well do it. You know, it's going to be more entertaining for us as well, rather than sitting there having an earnest conversation about things. I remember it very clearly, but it was like, it is. And so people get invited into, you know, when people host a dinner party, do they host it based on, you know, or cast it based on, we need everybody with the same ideology?
Well, people play this sort of game, don't they, and say, well, if you could invite anybody to a dinner party, living or dead, who were the people that you would invite? And it's very much about creating like an orchestra to perform the perfect dinner party for you.
Yeah, I mean, some of Hitler's gags are hilarious, to be honest with you. I mean, his routine about, you know, taking the piss out of Goebbels, just magnificent. And then he'll end on a song, you know, about his own one ball. I'm just going off now.
Well, you must have seen a lot of comedians over the years because you performed in clubs and places like the Comedy Store. So you've seen a lot of people.
Thousands.
And I suppose by the time somebody gets to the Comedy Store, they've already done the rounds in the small provincial clubs. And I used to go to some of those in my youth around Birmingham and London, and saw lots of acts who now people you see on TV, people like Harry Hill, and saw acts who we, you know, probably never heard of again and were utterly dreadful. And so it seems from what we're talking about that comedy, humour, to be funny, there's a context that's created. You're going to a comedy show, or this person's job within a social group has evolved into them being the person who lightens the mood, or at a specific event like you've talked about with the been invited for dinner there to provide the entertainment, to be funny. So, you know, for you to say, can you pass the salt, and everyone roars with laughter, and you're thinking, that wasn't even, no, I really do want the salt, and it just gets funnier the more you want the salt, even though you're actually getting quite angry with them. because the frame is he's the funny guy. So as exactly as you said, in that sense of social belonging, in order for me to show that I'm one of these beautiful people, I've got to laugh at the funny guy, because that's what's going on. That's the deal. So there's the context that's important. And I think probably what most people do is attribute the funniness to the person, but actually the context is playing a big part of it. So thinking about all the acts, all the people that you've seen, you must have seen some people and thought, it just isn't funny. You must have seen other people and thought, that's hilarious, it's incredible. How do you know, and this may sound like an obvious question, how do you know when someone or something is funny?
Well, by the way, people have to find their voice. And there are people who have a little bit of something. And the great thing about playing for so many years at the Comedy Store is there was an open spot on each show. And so, and most of the time you didn't want to go after the open spot because they would have killed the crowd. And you always, the funny thing about comedy is you want to ride the wave of somebody being good. You don't want to, you know.
So that's context again. If you come on after somebody who's funny, people are still feeling in that mood.
Yes.
And are more likely then to.
Oh, yeah. Because, it's contagious. And the reason why you have a compere at a comedy club is the compere has to be good enough. And worked with Bob Mills for years, Arthur Smith, Tim Clark. I mean, really great compares. But the best I've ever seen at is Bob Mills. Somebody would die on their arse, and it could be a booked act or an open spot. And then he would go and get the crowd back. And so he would do up to 10 minutes until they were ready and up there again. And then he would bring you on. And you're so, so grateful for that person because he's made your life easier. You don't have to, take them from nothing to that, because that's always harder. It's easier to work off the back of it and go, all right, you're ready to laugh. Good. Well, just go on. And one of the reasons you would, if one of the acts had picked on somebody in the audience, in the dressing room, you'd always go, what was the name of the guy you picked on? Because it was an easy link and an easy laugh. So you call back in terms of comedy, you're calling back and they go, oh God, they were really paying attention. Well, we weren't really paying attention. We just knew our craft in order to go, I've seen the guys act 20 times before. And the interesting bit to me was get the head round the corner. Oh, he's dealing with a heckler or he's having a go at somebody in the front row. They come off and you go, what was the name of the? Okay, I've logged that. And suddenly, Duncan will be getting, some kind of a line at some stage.
So it's even more than the material being rehearsed. You're also gathering clues about the interaction with the audience as well. You're trying to, I guess, control that environment as much as you can.
Yeah. Well, and now doing a lot of corporate stuff and speaking at conferences and stuff, I will always watch the person before me, because there might be one or two nuggets that will just help liven the thing up. In the Alistair McGowan interview, he talks about the guy who worked for the Waste Management Board, who had a deep Brummy accent, if you remember the thing. And because he said he sounded actually just like Adrian Childs. And so he came on and he just said in the accent, thanks very much to everything. And people went wild because it was a good facsimile of the accent. And that's what, comedy is about listening, ultimately. Because even in the office situation, you've got to, in order to get it, you have to have really listened and heard it. Because our comedy, when we meet, is around, you said that, I've listened, I've said something back, you've listened and you've topped it, or you've taken it to another level, or you've taken it off on a tangent, or you've brought it back later on. But ultimately, that's why I think people who have comedic tendencies and do comedy well are generally more intelligent. Now, that's a big statement, but I do think it's an ultimate intelligence to be able to listen to something, get a new context on it, twist it, and then take it back in order to make people laugh. I think that's...
Well, there does seem to be something there about making connections, especially when this is something spontaneous. I guess it's part of when you're writing comedy as well, but certainly when that's happening spontaneously, you're making connections. And we know that connectedness in the brain is one of the ways that intelligence is defined.
Yes. Yeah. I suppose it's how fast you can build those neural connections. And people are, if you can build them faster, which I think is what comedy or laughter is about, is like quickly build it, say something because you've gone off on a tangent. But I really have had to hear what you said first. And I really have to go and, okay, what's that? And then your comedy mind essentially will go, what does that mean? What are the connections out from that? Are any of these funny?
So something happens or somebody says something and my brain is connecting that to other pieces of information. It's connecting it to, when has this happened before? What does it mean? What do I do next? And one of those routes will be something funny, or a funny comparison, or a funny metaphor, or something like that. And for me to be in that role of the funny person, the person who lightens the mood, I will pick the funny metaphor as opposed to the, oh, that's terrible, something like that always happens to me, or woe is me kind of thing. I might be the person who says, well, you know, we all knew that was going to happen, or whatever it is, or the funny comment, or the lightning comment, or the funny metaphor. So it seems that there's both the connectedness plus also the preference for choosing the funny connection.
Yeah. And
that must be learned.
Well, it must be learned.
The simple question becomes, how do you go about learning what is funny in order to strengthen those funny connections and metaphors?
How do you go about learning it? It's a constant ongoing process. I think it's about listening. I always remember as a child listening and seeing if there was something funny to come back. And I kind of felt like it was a Rolodex in my head, where, you know, in the old days, people used to look for, or now you'd go, people are Googling, what are the connections with this thing? And the ultimate comedy thing is, what are the connections? Which one of those is going to be funny? Is there a word in what you just said that I can emphasize and take in another direction? You know, the joke I said earlier is, you know, why do mice have such small balls? It's like, okay, now let's concentrate on the word balls. What other context are balls happening? It's making a loose connection, but breaking the pattern that people have formed in their head, and break and taking them somewhere else. And when you take someone somewhere else, there's that jolt of, oh, I didn't think of it like that. But you've had to, and in a psychological sense, you've had to make them jump to another place, because the first reaction of the brain is, what does that mean? Oh, I get it. It means that. So I'm now going, oh, yeah. And now we're bonding over it. I'm also considered smart enough to play with you. So the person, well, we've all been in situations when people go, I don't get it. And essentially, they are somewhat ostracized from the
gang. Yes, I got a feeling of isolation when you said that. I don't get it. I imagined somebody feeling left out and not wanting to be left out.
And so then why do people work? Everybody wants to belong. It's the human state. You know, you want to belong to something. This is humor. It's belonging.
Thinking about when you learn to be funny, whenever that is, whether you learn to be funny as a child or whether later in life you go on a weekend workshop to learn to be funny, whatever point you do that, the sense I'm getting from you is that human beings will naturally group together and want to belong. So that's a given in the context. Human beings will laugh, and scholars and academics have argued and tried to figure out why we do that. And there seem to be a number of different reasons, but it's a given. So then the variable that's under the individual's control is, how do I know what I say is going to be funny? And just to make a kind of a logical leap, I suppose, it seems that you went through a process of trying of both listening to what other people laughed at and trying to figure out what was it that was funny about that. So you're not just copying what other people say. And secondly, trying out different things and noticing whether people laugh or not. And I'm guessing there were lots of times when you said something and nobody laughed.
Let's not go as far as lots of times. but you see, that is a funny line. Because what am I doing? I'm acting mock, sort of upset by that. But is what the comedy is. What's the appropriate thing? I could just answer straight and go, yes, there were, Peter. There were many times when and what you can't see out of shot is my wrists where I've slapped. No, you know, but it's true. But what I think it's an addiction, if anything. You want to make people laugh because there is an ultimate high.
Well, that's interesting for everybody, isn't it? Because I think I've read, you know, people theorizing that the sound of laughter is like a social signal. You know, chimpanzees do it, but they do it as a warning signal.
Yeah.
So it's some sort of social signaling mechanism. But it can't just be that, because not only do we make that distinctive sound, we also feel a tremendous sense of pleasure when we've been entertained, when we've laughed, when we've, you know, even just after a funny exchange with somebody at work, we feel a tremendous sense of pleasure. And when people come out of a comedy show, hopefully they feel a huge buzz, and you know, must be the performers as well. So there's something else going on. There's definitely a strong emotional, pleasurable emotional response.
Well, yeah, there's twofold. There's laughing yourself and making other people laugh. There's, you know, if you can get, well, you're getting double bubble, essentially, by doing both. And you go, well, I mean, I would say I'm addicted to making people laugh. I find it a compulsion. And, you know, it's better than most addictions. But it's kind of like I see it as something that gives me pleasure, but also very quickly bonds me with other people. If you go to the basics of anchoring, what you're trying to do is anchor people to want to be around you because that's good for business. So the in inverted commas, the more pleasant, the nicer you are, the funnier you are, the more likely that people are going to want to be around you, invite you to things, give you jobs, invite you to dinner parties, invite you to picnics or whatever, and everything. Oh, we'll have her because she's fun. She's fun.
Yeah, people actually say, he's a laugh, she's a laugh.
Yeah.
She's good fun.
Yeah, and by the way, that's the biggest stamp of approval that you can get, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, how many people do you want to invite to events when you go, very intelligent and earnest? And you go, I'm not sure I'm up for an intelligent and an earnest evening in the pub. But do you see what I mean? It's not...
So if an executive came to you and said, I'm not known as a humorous man, but and came to you and said, I want you to help me to be funnier.
Well, the what first thing is to do, well, the first thing you need to do is stop saying that to yourself, that I'm not a funny man.
Ah.
It's just so you because, you know, you're self-hypnotizing yourself into going, well, I'm not funny. Actually, the first rule of being funny is you have to think you're funny.
Well, does that mean that the first thing that you're doing as a comedian is telling jokes to yourself, making yourself laugh?
Yeah, I think you're practicing at all times.
On yourself. Yeah. And then not all of it comes out of your mouth.
Oh, I mean, you are editing constantly. I mean, sometimes for the amount of stuff that will go through every comedian's head, which is just not appropriate. But you're still, you will still get the, you know, you could get the sexist joke or everything. You just go, okay, I've seen it, I've heard it, but it's not going to come out of my mouth. It doesn't mean that you won't log what you could have said about that.
My wife Emma and I, when we're sitting on the sofa watching telly, we will make jokes about people on the telly that we both know we would never say to anybody else.
Absolutely, but that's allowed because it's that social inclusion of you go, we have this little place whereby we can be un-PC or whatever, but everybody does that. That's actually sometimes even more bonding. We know that you can't say this, but we are saying this, and it becomes funnier because we know that it is socially unacceptable. But you get little tribes of people, as long as you know what they're saying, everybody is doing that to some extent. You know, it's like, it's an inside joke. And you go, I'm saying it because it's outrageous. Well, if you look at comedy, Alf Garnett, which I was talking about, was Till Death Us Do Part, and he was a racist, misogynist character. But he was saying things that were, even at the time, not socially acceptable. But the writer, Johnny Spate, was doing this. These are real life people, and I want to show them up for what they are. So Alf Garnett was the butt of the joke and always lost because he was a thing. But that's why comedy is, you run into really difficult areas when you... You ban things because... Well,
if we just come back to our imaginary executive for a moment, then what I'm kind of piecing together from what you're saying is he's telling himself he's not a funny person. Maybe somebody else has told him he wasn't a funny person.
Yeah.
Maybe somebody else has told him he was humorless and he's internalized that.
Yep.
And yet, if we imagine that humor is... to some extent, a shared social human attribute, there must be something that amuses him. So whatever that is, maybe start with that.
Yeah, no, very good point. You would start with, you know, what makes you laugh?
because we've talked about authenticity, and you mentioned something a short time ago about, you didn't use the word authenticity, but about something about that being true to themselves or finding their voice, I think it was.
Find their voice, yeah.
So I guess part of that is discovering what is it that makes me laugh. And then the first step is I'm going to at least make myself laugh inside my own head through the commentary that I'm providing on the world anyway, rather than my commentary being, well, that's rubbish. I knew that was going to go wrong. That's terrible. That's not, you know, to make it up, you know, to amuse myself.
Well, and I think it's very important, and we're sort of building on what you said about if the executive comes to me, the problem is usually that they haven't found their voice. And I've seen this over time. So I will give you two examples. One is Jack D, UK comic, who used to come and do open spots and at the Comedy Store, and he used to be like Happy Jack, and he was like, here we go, and it never worked. And then one day he found that doer voice, and all the same gags worked because it was closer to his real thoughts, but it was also different and funnier. So maybe somebody who is an executive doesn't understand where they could do it, because, you know, somebody who's very quiet can still be very funny.
Right. And Hancock, for example, so humorless is funny when that is the context.
Yes,
and absolutely. The context of the person's own personality then creates that sense of authenticity. Because one of the things I've picked up from a number of things that you've said is that in humour there's a sense of altered reality that I'm going to describe, for example, this everyday situation, but I'm going to describe it in a way that makes there's something strange about it. We've talked about shows like The Fast Show and Monty Python, where we take something that's potentially ordinary, but then we change something about it to make it out of the ordinary.
It's a twist.
Yeah. So there's something about creating an alternate reality or creating a different way of interpreting reality. There's something about the alignment between the context and the personality, finding your own voice. So starting with what is it that maybe not make me laugh out loud, but what amuses me? Start that commentary inside my head. And then presumably at some point, I've got to take the risk that some of that commentary is going to spill out. I'm going to tell some of my jokes to another person. So what happens at that point when I'm at the point where I'm now amusing myself in my own head and I'm going to take the risk and externalize that? What happens at that point?
You are basically playing a game of comfort zone and coming out of it and trial and error. You know, is this funny? Is that funny? I mean, the other person I was going to talk about was Eddie Izzard, who was, and Eddie won't mind me saying this, but he was, I remember we were in New York together and I said, how did this get to this? And he said, I spent so many years not being funny or not being appreciated for my funny. I honed it and honed it and honed it until I found something that worked. And all comedians will have to, you know, find their voice. And for an executive, it's the same. For, you know, for anybody, it's the, what's your voice? Is that coming from somewhere? I went out for a drink with a couple of mates yesterday. And one of them is a mathematician who is quiet and very intelligent, super intelligent, and doesn't say as much as the other two of us say, but when he does, it's deadly and it's brilliant because he's really thought the thing through. So it's having daring to say it, It's the thing. And you can go, okay, I will dare to say it in some situations. But you won't go at the board meeting straight away. You know, with the chairman of the board, and also you have to learn that words don't live on their own in comedy. You know, if you want to call somebody, if I want to call you Four Eyes, it could be offensive. But if I do a face that goes, I know this, you know I'm kidding, then I will get away with it. It's actually understanding that it doesn't come from one level. You know, you can't just say a thing. I'll give you an example. My late father's wife, and I think I've said this before, but you know, spoke six languages and was dull in every one of them. But I would turn up at the dinner table with people I didn't know, much older people, and I would gently take the mickey out of them, sometimes not so gently, but they knew I was joking. She'd known them for years and years and years and would listen to me say something, and you know, which was essentially an insult, like me going Four Eyes to you. It was essentially an insult, but I was doing it with that kind of face. Oh, yeah.
Well, I think in a lot of groups and families particularly, that becomes part of the language of that group.
Yeah, unless you don't speak that language, which my father's wife didn't speak that language. And 5 minutes after I'd done it, she'd just get it into her head that I will say something that is insulting. And the whole table would just absolutely, the atmosphere would change because it was just awkward. And so she hadn't factored in that it's not the, I'm going to call you Four Eyes, you know. And she hadn't factored in that there was lots of levels I was working. I was teasing. And teasing involves you to understand, and this is where it comes in, that this is a joke. This is me.
It sounds like an interpersonal game that people get into, and again, within certain families, groups of friends and so on, that if I insult you a little bit and you stay around, if I give you a little push away and you stay here, then you must really love us, you must really love me, you must really want to be part of this. So it's a way of, I think in part, it's a way of testing the strength of those social connections.
It is testing. I will tell you a story, because my father died 4.5 years ago. Rich vein for comedy. But we went for his memorial service, and I went to see my brother and his wife, who I love dearly, in Hungary. And I turned up through the door, and I had no intention of doing this, but they had somber looks on their faces. And we knew that we were there because our father had died, and his wife was very, very lovely and giving, and sort of like was kind of doing that, I'm so sorry, you know, is there anything I can do? And I went, you know, my father died at 89, and I went, bastard. He knew we wanted to have a party, and he had to go before we had a 90th birthday party. And the look on her face was first horror, and then she broke into, and with my brother, broke into reams of laughter. It was completely inappropriate. But actually, it is what my father would have liked.
Right. So there's an element there of that alternate reality. It's, you know, as much as nobody wants to say the words, it kind of is the thing that he would have done.
Yeah, he would have done, and he would have appreciated the gag. Now, does it make us less sad or less respectful? The answer's no. But actually, I'd rather break that state of like, are we all going to be, you know, wringing our hands and saying, wasn't it awful? Or shall we remember the good stuff about him and work from there? And maybe it was me, just I didn't like the whole atmosphere. And so I had to change that atmosphere. Now, I had no premeditated thing that I was going to do. I have no conscious memory of going, what we need now is a gag to break.
Well, not premeditated, pre-planned in that moment, but certainly based on a lifetime of preferring the amusing connection.
It's easier for me. Yeah, it's an easier way through, and it's an easier bonding tool for me. And I think humor is the quickest bonding tool. So, which is why, you know, humorology exists, is so that we can go, look, this is important at every level. It's important at the level of human connection, and nobody's really brought it to the fore to this level. So, I mean, it's so
just going back to our imaginary executive. First step, identify what amuses him. Second step, change the internal dialogue to at least amuse himself. Third step, take the risk to now externalize some of that. So it seems that the key distinction with somebody who's known as being funny is that they just say that stuff out loud. And sometimes that joke, that comment won't land, won't have the effect, and it will be ignored or dismissed or create confusion or whatever. So there seems to be an important step in how they deal with feedback.
Yeah, there is.
From what you're saying and the joke you made about, you know, most of the, you know, must have been lots of times when it wasn't funny. So the joke you made about that seemed to be suggesting that naturally you've reinforced the times when it was funny, it did have the desired effect, and diminished the importance of the times when it didn't. Whereas somebody who would get discouraged from being funny would tentatively launch a comment, it wouldn't go down as they hoped, and that's put me right off.
They've backed off completely. And as whereas if this is why I said at the start that I would stop their, I would change their belief system first, because I'm not funny. I'm one of those. I think the first thing you said was I'm not very amusing in those situations. So you need to change the belief system, because if your belief system is supporting you, what you will do when something, as we say in comedy, dies on its arse, is you will admit it, and you might get a laugh off the back of admitting it. Mm. It's how you deal with the thing, you know.
Well, there seems to be the key difference here seems to be in the framing or the interpretation of the response. So if our imaginary executive tries out a joke in the next board meeting and gets a laugh or a smile or something, of course he's going to feel good about that to some level. That's going to help to reinforce that. But if he tries that and it doesn't, you know, he gets some frowns or blank faces or whatever, it seems that a critical thing is what judgment he places on that. So for you as a comedian, when you're in that role, when you say something that is intended to be funny and you get confused blank faces, how do you interpret that response?
Well, you have to interpret it as it's my fault. You know, meaning of my communication is the response I get.
Well, you say you have to. How do you, in that instant that you get a eyebrows down, confused look, how do you feel in that instant?
It's a devastating thing. It's a thing, but you can't concentrate on the devastation.
But it's interesting that feeling inspires you to try again rather than stop.
Yeah, but I think that's a competitive thing of like, I can win this. I can win this over. I can get this back.
So the driver then for getting people to laugh is something about making that social connection.
Yes, I'm It has to be. Yeah, I don't want to let it go. I want to win them over. I want to make sure that they, in inverted commas, like me. And so now I'm going to keep going. Now I need another variant on that, which goes, I get that wasn't funny or to you. You know, I did my best, but I'm going to keep on going because I you know, I've got some other ways of connecting. I mean, comedians will have a myriad of ways to do it. And, you know, if something doesn't land, what, you know, you accept it and, you know, you will look to the wings and go, you know, blah, 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 nothing. Start the car. You know, it's an admission. But actually, start the car might get you a titter back into your rhythm. But I'm not giving up. I'm sticking.
Two things seem to be happening there. There's both an authenticity, and we've talked about the acknowledgement of how it is. But also, it sounds like there's something there about pacing the audience's expectations. And if the audience are thinking, oh, this is going to be terrible, they're imagining the future. And what the comedian's just done is pace that.
Yes.
Start the car. It almost as if the comedian's spoken to the audience who are thinking, this is going to be terrible.
Yeah.
And saying, I know what you're thinking and I'm with you on that. So they've flipped it into creating that social connection through that anticipation.
Well, and the best person I've ever seen do that is Alan Davis. And I think in the Humorology podcast, I talked with Alistair McGowan about Alistair used to shamble on stage and just talk nonsense and everything. And just as the audience was starting to get sort of anxious and thinking he's not funny, he goes, you know, oh, don't go thinking I'm shit. Because I'm just warming up. You don't go, imagine, athletes don't just go in and I'm going to run 100 metres, you know, and he'd do that. And there was such a relief.
Say, you don't go to work and sit down at 9 o'clock and start typing. You have a cup of coffee and you have a chat. And
absolutely. And that was the whole thing. And it made it relatable. So he was working off the back of, like, this is what people do. But he'd also push the danger element of it. And I think that the comedians or people who want to be funny have to understand that funny involves sometimes going over people's lines or you have to be able to push the boundary of, well, you don't have to be Frankie Boyle, by the way, who is a brilliant comedian and is very, very smart. But you do have to be prepared to push people's boundaries in a good way. Now, I'm not saying you have to, you know, I will give you an example that happened to me recently. The TV show I worked on, School of Hard Knocks, one of the women lives round the corner who worked with a lot of the guys we helped, and she was a mentor to them. And she came in, and she's in her mid to late 30s, a younger group than me, and they said, come and join our group. And I went, I don't want to be a, you know, thing. No, we'd love to have you and everything. So you go into a long group. I'm not trying to do that. We get on very well. The thing that bonds us is humour. Afterwards, she said, I couldn't believe what you did with my friend, this female, very tall woman, very, very, she's so smart. And I couldn't believe that what you were saying to her, and she didn't get angry. And basically, I'd reached such a level of rapport with her that I was teasing her. Now, it was on the surface, if you'd written it down, it was not funny, but I kept on teasing her. And I was just playing the role of a guy. I was saying, you do realise that women's brains are tiny, don't you? I mean, it's a scientific fact. And I was just playing this obnoxious role. And she was lapping it up and reeling with laughter because we'd reached that social bond whereby she knew that it was so far away from my belief system that it had become funny. But if you were looking from the outside and you go, God, I thought she'd be really upset by you saying that. Well, no, she's not going to be really upset because we've established that I'm not that person. And now we're doing ridiculous. We're playing at the ridiculousness of what I'm saying, which makes it funnier.
Now, going back to our imaginary executive trying a joke in the boardroom, it doesn't have the effect he hoped for. And rather than being discouraged by that, he doesn't like it. He knows that it didn't go well. He doesn't pretend that it didn't. But rather than being discouraged, it seems that what you're saying, because the overriding driver is to make that social connection, that actually if you don't achieve that, if what you say doesn't have the desired effect, that actually has the effect of increasing your desire to make the social connection. So that's what pulls you in more to try again, to keep trying something different.
Yeah.
And coming back to what we talked about from a leadership point of view then, that executive making a joke in the boardroom is signaling something about how he sees the world, what makes him laugh. And other people are either going to naturally find that funny, or because of the context, they're going to adjust their perspective to find it funny, because that's part of how that social group is evolving and developing.
Yes, I think that's very well put. But what I was thinking when you were saying that is, it's also the persistence of going, of carrying that on, because I was thinking, if I was that executive or if I was giving advice to that executive, I would say, you know, you have to admit that that didn't land at the end of that. You know, and you can do that in many ways. You can keep the thing. For instance, you go, da, 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 tumbleweed, nothing happens. You go, oh, didn't find that funny. It's a strange way to hand in your notice, you know. It's so you've done something off the back of that and everything. Now that might get you a titter. I've admitted that thing. I won't give up the day job is a perfectly valid thing to go. I admit that I'm not. It wasn't funny that time. I won't give up the day job. Perfect. But you need to have something in your back pocket that does it. But given the alternative of just being dour, I would say to any executive, you've got to find a way. Now, it will be your way and it has to be authentic, but you have to find a way to get at least one level of humour out there, because it will make people feel more comfortable. Mm. It will ultimately bond you with your team much more. So
one of the things that I know, we know that psychological safety is vital in any situation, but if we're talking about the workplace, we know that leaders who build psychological safety in their teams build closer knit, more engaged, more productive teams and workplaces. And one of the things I hear very often about people talking about leaders or managers who are very difficult to work for, who don't create that psychological safety, they'll say, I never know how to take him or her. I never know where I stand. And it seems from what you're saying here that the leader who uses humour is signalling different types of communication, different responses, different situations, the leader signaling, because people have often said, they'll in a team meeting, for example, they'll talk about something that isn't going very well. And one day the manager could say, oh, well, just, stay on top of it. And the next, the next day they could explode, and the next day they could. And it seems like that manager who is unable to regulate their own responses creates a lot of uncertainty and risk. And what it leads to is a yes culture where people hide mistakes, hide problems. Then those problems become very big before anybody does anything about them. And actually it's hugely unproductive. But it seems that the leader who is using humor as part of constructing that culture of psychological safety is signaling to people when something's okay and there's no need to worry, and when something's serious, and is diffusing some of the tension that maybe then otherwise would lead to some of those explosive situations that people go out of their way to avoid.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely it. The psychological safety is crucial to the bonding mechanism. So if you don't have that, it's about communication, isn't it? It's can I communicate with this person? Well, the first thing is that I've got to understand that psychological safety, actually, when you said it earlier on, I was thinking psychological safety is really I don't feel listened to. And that takes us back to, in order to actually be funny, to be humorous, you have to listen to people. So the psychological safety will happen when somebody has listened properly and can then deliver a funny line or an amusing line, let's just say, as a result of it. So now what this subtext is that, oh, I have been listened to. And one of the biggest complaints in business is I don't feel listened to. So the excellent executive will be listening, and the ultimate listening is a humorous listening whereby they can not only have listened but perhaps diffuse people's worries, traumas, or lessen the impact of certain situations, and bring people together using that. And I think that's what changes, is that somebody who can do that has listened properly, and all great comedy is about listening.
Very interesting. So if we were to patent whatever the word is, teaching people how to be funny process, just to recap on that, we've got, start with noticing what it is that amuses you, number one. Step number two, switch the internal dialogue to the commentary that is along the lines of what amuses you, whatever that is. Step three is then start to vocalize some of those comments. Step four is watch for the reaction from other people. And because the underlying purpose is not just to make people laugh, that's not an end in itself. The underlying purpose is to strengthen the social connection. And therefore, step four is, if the response I get from the other person is that they laugh or they smile, that feels good, that naturally strengthens my desire to do more of that, and I can see that I've strengthened that connection and I can hear that. And if the response is not what I'd hoped for, if it's confusion or disapproval, the bad feeling, the detaching feeling that I get pulls me back to attempt to remake that social connection that I've now, like a rubber band, I've stretched it a little bit.
Yeah.
It makes me want to come back and try again. So I don't have to have a way of dealing with discouragement, because the, the fundamental driver being to reinforce or strengthen that social connection is going to feed that discouragement right back into the start of the process and make me think of something else that's funny to say. So if we say that humor is part of one of the natural attributes of human beings, we all have it, we all find something funny. The people who we pay to be funny, pay to go and see to be funny, are just the people who have practiced saying more of what amuses them.
Yeah.
From a leadership point of view, we will associate with some comedians and not others. We will prefer some film, some TV show to others, because that's signaling our alignment of our personality, our values, our beliefs, whatever it might be, with those people. So there's the connection from a leadership point of view. I'm going to build an executive isn't going to build a group of direct reports or a board on the basis of their people who find him funny, although we know that there are leaders who do that, that they will surround themselves with people who say what they want to hear, laugh at their jokes. That will be one of the key things. So, but that's not going to be the primary driver, but it's helping people to identify with that group or not, or say, do you know what? I don't like the culture. I don't like the way this group, this board, this team operates. I'm going to go somewhere else. And that's fine too, because from a leadership point of view, you can only build your own culture. You can't build anybody else's. No. We can't create. I know we talk about inclusivity and so on, but we can't build a leadership culture that's right for everybody. We can build a culture that is inclusive in the sense that everybody is welcome, but they will like working there or they won't. And I think the bigger picture of inclusivity is respecting people's choice to say, this isn't for me, and making that absolutely fine and no big deal and no hard feelings. And, you know, let me help you, you know, ease you into the next role, position, whatever it might be. And some people complain that tends towards leadership cults, that, you know, only the right sort of, but that's the case anyway. A cult is a culture. So
yeah.
No, always, you know, we don't have to be friends with everybody. If you think about your circle of friends, you choose friends who you want to be friends with. You know, nobody's going to say, you know, there's a new EU directive that says you have to be friends with everybody.
Well, that's why we're leaving the EU.
Nothing. Yes. That's actually what they were doing. Those unelected bureaucrats that we elected.
Yeah. That's why I voted out. Yeah. Because I was going to be told who to be friends with.
Yeah, you got to have a friend from every country in the EU for inclusivity.
Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head.
That's very interesting. Thank you for sharing all of that with me.
It's my pleasure.
Well, that's all for now. And I hope you've gotten as much from listening to this podcast as I got from making it. If you've got any questions or any suggestions about people you think I should be interviewing, then do get in touch and let me know. Otherwise, I very much look forward to next time. Take care.